This Israel report is brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you are based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.
The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, Boker Tov, Shavua Tov. How are you?
Boker Tov, Shavua Tov. Really, really nice, warming picture, actually, that shows Chief of General Staff Eyal Zamir during a tour that he was making of northern Gaza. And while he was there, he came across his son, who is a reserve tank company commander, only known in the public as Major A, obviously a reserve major, company commander in the armored corps. And they bumped into each other in northern Gaza while the chief of general staff was making his tour of duty, making his rounds. Apparently, Major A has been serving in the tank brigade since the beginning of the war. As a reserve commander, and obviously with his father being the chief of general staff, I guess it has a certain different touch and feel to it, but it kind of shows that all Israeli families are impacted in some way by the reserve duties that people have to serve, and it was just a nice picture. Ironically, in the picture, it was his son whose face was blurred out so that we couldn't identify him, rather than Chief of General Staff Zamir himself. So quite an interesting picture, and just one which brings a little bit of the family warmth, a little bit more of the personal touch to what's going on in Gaza, which, of course, is not particularly warming at all. But before we talk about things going on in Gaza, last week I spoke a little about some of the little snippets that have come out from the 12-day war. And we'd call it the 12-day war because we feel that the war, that particular aspect of the war, Operation Rising Lions, is over. But the reality is that it really does not seem to be over at all, because there are so many things going on in Iran right now, and that checking them as I think would be like just not nearly enough to cover some of the things that have been going on even since the end of the war and even since the ceasefire was formally declared. We've heard stories about drones attacking buildings that house, not coincidentally, senior members of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. And we've heard about oil refinery fires, and we've heard about explosions in drone manufacturing facilities. None of these really seem to be coincidental. They all seem to be very much strategic in the way that they happen. The Iranian government has chosen to try to explain these events by saying, oh, gas leaks and gas explosions. That seems to be the one excuse that is very, very easy to wheel out. And the way that the Iranian opposition have responded to this excuse of gas leaks is that they've reconstructed the logo of the Iranian gas company, showing the face of Prime Minister Netanyahu as the main part of the Iranian gas company logo. So that is their kind of indirect way of trying to explain what these gas leaks have been all about. But it's quite amazing to watch that even though the ceasefire is formally in place, and even though both parties maintain that they are adhering to the ceasefire, these unexplained events continuously are going on almost every day. And against that comes the Iranian announcement that they have now rebuilt and reconstructed and repaired their anti-missile system such that Iranian skies are once again safe, which they really weren't to begin with. So you can't really say they are once again when they really weren't at the start. And Israel, as we know, had free operation over the skies of Iran. Admittedly, what we what's very difficult for us to understand because it's so played down, we don't really get all the inside information about how this was achieved. But that first wave of aircraft that went into Iran on that Thursday night, late Thursday night, Friday morning, first attacked the anti-air missile defense systems in Iran and completely took them out of the picture so that Israel did indeed have freedom of movement in the skies of Iran. It all seemed to be very easy from our bomb shelters in Israel to achieve that. But the reality is that the planning, that the intelligence, that the accuracy of execution was just phenomenal. And as I mentioned last week, no aircraft were lost at all, which really was way beyond the expectations of the military system, the military infrastructure, who had planned for the loss of perhaps even as many as 10 aircraft along with the crew that go with that. So, yeah, just a little bit more from the so-called 12-day war, which seems to be going on and on.
Anthony, the fact that Iran is choosing not to react and blame Israel speaks to either hesitancy in getting involved in another act of war or giving Israel credit. What do you think it is?
Oh, I think that Iran understands that if they were to respond to these acts that Israel is carrying out from within Iran, that the next phase of any war that might break out would be extremely much more damaging than was the first 12 days that they experienced. I think that they understood that. I mean, one of the things that I think forced them into agreeing to the ceasefire was because they just couldn't see their way forward to what might happen over the next 12 days. And that comes also against the backdrop of the fact that the Iranian missiles being fired towards Israel were being much more successful and more accurate in the second week of the war than they were in the first week. And we can talk a little bit about that because the missile accuracy that we were receiving, we noticed that there were many more hits in Israel with many fewer missiles being fired than towards the end of that 12-day period than was the case in the beginning, where we were getting massive barrages of rockets being fired, many, many rockets trying to overwhelm our anti-air defense missile systems. And yet the accuracy was pretty low. By the end, far fewer missiles were being fired with much greater accuracy. We don't really know, at least in the public domain, why that was, whether potentially Iran was using more accurate missiles, whether they were using a slightly different ballistic missile to aim towards Israel, which was more accurate. I don't know. And we're not being told any of that. And we also don't know how many more of those missiles Iran had at their disposal, and whether the fact that they were running out of supplies was one of the reasons why they felt they had to stop the war after 12 days. But I feel sure that the hits that they took in Iran and the damage that was done to people and to infrastructure and to the accuracy of the operations in Iran was the main reason why they decided they didn't want to continue. And is probably also the reason why they feel at the moment they just cannot respond for fear of what may happen next.
More than 1,000 people are reported to have been killed in the attacks against the Druze in southern Syria. What's the latest there?
Wow, what a story this has been, really. I mean, and not really, not carried in the international press. I mean, no outrage, no demonstrations.
Nothing.
No,
over 1,000 people flags. Killed and not even, it's just remarkable.
Yeah, and I mean, ironically, the focus has been on a missile that the IDF fired and inadvertently hit a Catholic church in Gaza. And I think three people might have been killed in the church. And as a result of that, the Prime Minister phoned the Pope in order to apologize for this inadvertent error. But of course, phone calls and demonstrations and criticisms and front page newspaper articles about the church in Gaza that was hit, which of course nobody condones and nobody thinks is a good thing. And yet 1,000 people have been killed around the area of Sweida, and it seems to be almost not reported. I'm not quite sure what you've been seeing in your local press,
no, but
it
hardly,
seems to be very
hardly.
Much not reported. And some of the evil acts that have been carried out, and you know, the parties involved, because initially it was the Syrian government forces, and then the Bedouins tribes in the local area got involved in order to support the Syrian government forces. When the Syrian government pulled back their forces, then the Bedouins got involved supporting that and also massacring the Druze. And then the Druze have armed themselves, and apparently quite a large number of Israeli Druze have gone across from Israel to Syria. Some of them, we understand, even IDF reserve soldiers getting involved in defending the Druze community in Syria, and ceasefires having been declared on 3 or 4 different occasions, which don't seem to hold out. And then another clip of people being massacred in the most evil way, whether it be in their hospital beds or whether they be pushed over balconies or shot as they're jumping over the balcony to try and save their lives. It's just been absolutely horrendous. We do understand that Israel has continued to be involved over the weekend in order to try to protect the Druze, both by sending drones and planes to attack targets around the Sweida area that could potentially have constituted a threat to the Druze, and also sending in lots of aid and just humanitarian assistance to help the Druze community, who have literally been massacred in Sweida. I mean, if you think about 1,000 people being killed in a relatively small community, that's really quite a significant hit for them. We understand that something like 1,120 people have been killed in that minority community. Apparently, according to the reports, 400 of them, just a little bit more than 400, were Druze fighters. About 300 were civilians, and apparently 194 of them were summarily executed by defense and interior ministry personnel from Syria, even though the Syrian president has formally announced that the fighting should stop and that Syrian government forces should be sent to try to secure the area around Sweida to try and stop the fighting. And yet it just seemed to continue. And certainly the Bedouin tribes don't feel beholden to any government announcements that might have been made. So even though Syrian President al-Julani has formally made a statement saying, let's call a truce, has criticized Israel, has said that Israel has been the source of the massacre, the reason why this particular conflict arose. The reality of the matter is that this was an attack by Syrian government forces under the leadership of Julani, many of them carrying ISIS weapons and ISIS symbolism, logos and things like that on their uniforms. I think it has kind of changed a little the way in which we view the Syrian regime at the moment. Al-Julani has been received on all the greatest stages around Europe. He's been lauded as a former ISIS, a former Al-Qaeda member, to become suddenly someone who's being welcomed in the presidential palaces around Europe and around the world. But this is really a stain on his record. And if he was trying to rehabilitate his image and to try and take over as a legitimate world leader, I think that this has really damaged that effort. I just wonder whether the main protagonists around the world have noticed what's going on.
Whether they have or haven't, it is, or whether they choose to or not choose to, the way in which you can juxtapose anything happening in Syria with what's happening in Gaza is just mind-blowing. Speaking of Gaza, fighting continues in Gaza in the absence of a ceasefire agreement. So what is IDF strategy now? This just seems to be carrying on and carrying on, and you just wonder where this is going.
It's really dragging, and the first strategy, which was being promoted quite significantly by the Prime Minister is the so-called idea of humanitarian cities in Gaza. And the idea was to try and move civilians into these sort of encampments, which would be humanitarian encampments, would be guarded by the IDF, and people would be moved there in order to secure them and also to potentially clean out other areas of Gaza. This idea has not been particularly well received. It sort of had the feel of almost like a concentration camp in Gaza, which didn't really go down well. There were some people who felt that those so-called humanitarian cities might be holding zones to somehow try and export people from Gaza, which the Prime Minister denied. So from what I can gather, the idea of the humanitarian cities has been parked for a moment. And now we understand that the Chief of General Staff, Eyal Zamir, is promoting an idea where the IDF will effectively take control over much, much more of Gaza than is even the current situation. So to try and take more control, to try and get more involved, not necessarily encircle Gaza completely, but to certainly encircle large swathes of Gaza, and to secure them and to try and keep control like that, which means really increasing the intensity of the fighting in order to take control of those areas, and then to keep IDF troops around that area in order to secure the pieces of Gaza that have been taken over by the IDF. We understand that even though the Chief of General Staff has been promoting this amongst members of the Security Cabinet who seem to be overall supportive of this idea, the Prime Minister, not so much. And I think the reason for that is that the Prime Minister still seems to be holding out that some sort of a ceasefire arrangement could be reached. And I think the two are not mutually exclusive. So I think we could say if a ceasefire is not reached within a relatively reasonable period of time, I don't know what that might be, then we can move to this particular operating model of trying to secure more of Gaza. But there are certainly some very difficult decisions to be made in the near future about what we do there next.
That is where we leave it. Anthony Rock, thank you. As always, you can catch Anthony tomorrow morning, 7:45, for the Israel Report.
That Israel Report was brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you're based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.